When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Bureaucrats Gone Wild edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. It's been a busy week. The President of the United States has been jetting all over the world, including to Saudi Arabia. We're going to talk about what exactly is going on there. We're going to talk about Saudi Arabia, the oil price, and what that has to do with venture capitalists and private equity types in the United States. It's all connected. We are going to talk also about the World Bank and specifically its chief economist, Paul Romer, and his war against what is known as bank speak. You're going to want to listen to some of this bank speak. It's kind of awesome stuff. So that's all to come. I am Felix Salmon of Fusion. We are joined, as ever, by Anna Szymanski and Jordan Weissman. Hello, people.
Hello.
And I think that first we should talk about Brazil.
I think so.
I think we should.
So why are we talking about Brazil?
We are talking about Brazil because over the past few weeks, another president with very low approval ratings facing calls for resignation and possible impeachment as a result of corruption allegations has been in the news. And this is, in fact, Michel Temer, the current president of Brazil, who's been implicated in an ongoing corruption scandal after an audio tape was released appearing to prove that he had sanctioned a number of bribe payments.
So, now, I mean, he hasn't been president very long.
He has not, because he took over after Dilma Rousseff was impeached last year. Now, it's important to remember that Rousseff was actually not impeached because of the corruption scandal. She was impeached for what we like to call in EM creative accounting.
But the fact is, she was corrupt.
She was.
And her predecessor, Lula, who we all know and love, was also corrupt.
Yes.
It seems to be the case that it takes, what, 10 minutes after assuming the presidency to just start, like, becoming unbelievably corrupt, both accepting and paying enormous amounts of bribes.
I think people are also corrupt in Brazil before they assume the presidency as well. You don't have to wait, Felix.
No.
Brazil is in turmoil. In 140 characters or less, Anna, what exactly is the corruption scandal in Brazil?
So there are a number of scandals, but the central one is the Lava Jato corruption scandal, which involves kickbacks paid to the state-owned oil company Petrobras that implicated, at this point, essentially every political party and many of the biggest industries in Brazil. The bribes that were paid at this point, we're looking at over 6.4 billion reais.
And what's that in dollars?
Right now, I think it's what we were like 3.27. So it's a little over $2 billion.
So what basically happened was Petrobras, the state oil company, would hire these construction contractors at inflated rates and have these kind of pretend competitions. And then the contractors would kick back money to some of the executives at the oil company, who then in turn would go and pay bribes to politicians who were influential in deciding essentially how the oil company was managed, because it's mostly state owned.
Yes. And again, a lot of this money would just be funneled, especially to the Workers' Party, which is the party of Dilma Rousseff and Lula Silva.
And in terms of income inequality, we can also add that Lula apparently got $50 million of bribes, while Dilma only got $30 million of bribes. So women just don't get as much, paid as much as men.
All right.
Anna, as the emerging markets sort of finance type, you can tell us what's happened to stock prices in Brazil.
So we did see a bit of a move downwards in the Bovespa, the Brazilian equity market, as well as the value of the real, the Brazilian currency. Now, there's been some recovery. And if you look at overall trends, the real is still fairly strong. The market is still somewhat strong. But this has been one of the first real instances of market jitters in an EM economy.
And there was one day where the market fell like over 10% one day.
But if you look at an overall trend, it's still relatively high compared to where it was, say, before Rousseff was impeached.
So what we have is, as you say, a case of political turmoil turning into market turmoil. But more to the point, we have a case of a country which just seems to be impossible to govern without just astonishing levels of corruption.
And I don't think this is specific to Brazil. This is what happens in pretty much every EM economy. If you look at like world corruption lists, Brazil isn't even in the top 10. I don't even think they're in the top 20.
Now, you see, I disagree about this. I think, and I disagree in part based on this rather excellent Business Week piece about like the whole history of corruption in Brazil and how it all dates back to the emperor in the late 19th century, who was just kind of installed. This Portuguese guy gets installed, and there's this court, and that feeling of like having an emperor in a court never really went away. And it's certainly true, even absent illegal corruption, that some enormous amount of sort of upper middle class civil society in Brazil is made up of politicians paying themselves enormous salaries, giving themselves enormous pensions, and not really producing anything. And
right, but name an EM country for me where that is not the case.
Well, how about Chile next door?
Well, and actually Chile has recently been reforming. So they're a potentially an example of where when you start to crack down on corruption, you start to see some benefits.
So this all kind of gets to the big question I have. And I should say at the start here that I have not been following Brazil's story closely for months and months and months. Some people have been like addicted to this soap opera. But, you know, I've started reading about it and it kind of, in a weird way, brought me back to some of my college courses in political science. And Felix is giving me kind of a look right here, but I promise this is going somewhere. So there's, like, I had this professor, Jeffrey Winters, and he specialized in kind of emerging economies, politics, especially Southeast Asia. And he had this theory that said that corruption was essentially not deadly for an economy, that it could be managed as long as it was predictable, right? As long as you could have this sort of like you could have this thing where bureaucrats are paying themselves huge salaries and skimming some money from projects like oil companies, whatnot. As long as everyone kind of understood how the system worked and there was someone kind of, you know, his term was taming the oligarchs, taming all these people doing it. But and so to me, it seems like the markets have all sort of internalized that idea that you can do business in these places as long as the corruption is predictable. But now you've got Brazil, where markets are freaking out and everything seems to be falling apart despite years of absolutely predictable corruption.
Okay, and I think there are two reactions to that I would make. Number one is I think that your professor was spending too much time looking at Indonesia.
Okay.
And Indonesia has always been the poster child for, look, you can have enormous growth and corruption in the Suharto era.
Yeah.
And it was true. And I think that it's a little bit dangerous to extrapolate from Suharto to the rest of the world, and especially to Brazil. Second, the Brazil was not nearly as openly corrupt as Suharto was. Suharto, everyone knew, was corrupt. He, you know, he had, like, you know, just billions of dollars, and it was open, and he was the, you know, he ran the country with an iron fist, and there was nothing anyone could do about it. What you have in Brazil with the secret payments from companies like Odebrecht and Petrobras to the government was actually surprising to a lot of Brazilian society when these payments came out.
And the extent of it was surprising.
And then finally, I would just say that the markets sort of freaking out about this is not really them freaking out about the corruption. It's them freaking out about the political implications, which is that because every single politician in Brazil is presumptively tainted by this, and because Brazil is clearly fed up with it and wants to, like, kick all of the bums out, there is a real risk that there's not going to be anyone left to run the country.
The reason the markets are freaking out is because they think that pension reform isn't going to go through.
Do you mind unpacking that a little?
Yeah. So essentially, when Temer came in, one of the reasons that so much money started to flow back into Brazil was because there was the expectation that he was going to push through pension reform, labor market reform, and tax reform that was going to liberalize the economy, make it less rigid. And also, they have a very unsustainable pension system. And so he was going to help reduce the fiscal deficit, because they have a very, it's like 10% fiscal deficit. So he was going to help reduce that and make it more business friendly and more apt to have long-term growth. So now the fear, and again, I would argue that part of the reason that we haven't seen quite the sell-off you really would anticipate, because people still think, like, well, maybe the next guy who comes in can push this through. But the real concern is about structural reform more than anything else, because I found this fascinating when the Brazilian crisis was going on, was that investors started to price in pension reform almost before Rousseff was even impeached. Just when it became clear that she was probably going to be impeached, you started to see money flowing back into these markets. And partly because you had some underpricing of decent assets and a number of other much more complicated reasons. But I think it again goes back to markets wanting to believe these positive stories.
And markets also just missing the big picture, right? Like, they can look at the economics, and they love looking at the economics, but what they're missing is this big idea that the country will put up with a certain amount of corruption until it won't. Yeah. And that when that happens, the entire entire civil society can just fall apart.
So this is what I kind of wanted to ask you, Anna, which is, you know, as someone who actually has been on the investor side dealing with emerging market economies, how do you price in corruption? How do you think about corruption when you're looking at an economy as a place to park your money or whatnot?
Yeah, and this is really important, because in EM, you kind of talk about counterparty risk. Now, this is a really big deal if you're talking about private investments, because as an American investor, you have to be very clear that the people you're investing with are not involved in corruption. I mean, that's actually really important. And I think this goes back to a larger issue in terms of why, when a society is very corrupt, it can get to a certain level of growth, but it can't get past that. Because if you have just endemic corruption, it stops a number of foreign investors from the US and Europe from really getting involved, because they can't get involved with systems that are quite that corrupt.
Although, you know, I mean, I remember the Korea crisis of 1997-98, where a whole bunch of very corrupt tribals started sort of falling apart because the currency was in trouble. But the fact is that in the decades leading up to the late 90s, Korea did very well despite, and had high levels of economic growth despite also having quite a lot of corruption. No?
Right. But you also have to look into what's fueling that. And so with Brazil in particular, I also think it's easier to have corruption when you have a commodity boom and you have tons of money flowing in.
It sounds a lot like sort of the way any boom will paper over, you know, bad business practices. And like in the US, when everyone was making money off the housing bubble, people were happy to throw their money at, you know, subprime mortgages and whatnot. And then when the tide came out, you know, you saw who was wearing a swimsuit or whatnot.
Yeah, right. I think it's different than that. I think commodity booms are different. And
okay.
I think that you can actually draw a distinction between corruption in large commodity exporters, like, say, Nigeria or Brazil, and corruption in countries which are less based on commodity exports, like, say, Indonesia or Korea. And that where you have the leaders just simply basically extracting rents from oil exporters, that is going to leave a country without a lot of underlying economic vitality.
And I think that that's actually really important if you want to talk about long-term growth and why corruption is such a big problem, is because what corruption does is it really solidifies income inequality in a lot of these nations. We see that especially in Brazil. There's been some reduction in income inequality, but it still is a very inequitable society. And the problem is that when this happens, the elites, which often are connected with the government, have no incentive to modernize the economy, liberalize the economy, because they're essentially just extracting rents, making lots of money. And so then what happens is you get, not surprisingly, lots of discontent among the population because they have no opportunity. So then what often happens? Well, they elect populist leaders. But then the populist leaders are often the worst in terms of, frankly, corruption. And so it just creates this cycle that you can't get out of, and it really hurts a lot of developing economies and stops them from ever really getting out of that middle income trap. They essentially constantly hit a ceiling in terms of what they can achieve because of this endemic corruption. Again, we don't just see it in Brazil. We don't just see it in Latin America. We see it in a lot of the former Soviet
states. Well, I mean, this is the perfect segue. I have to kind of like do this at this point, that we're now going to talk about Saudi Arabia, right? I mean, in Saudi Arabia, it is so entrenched that the ruling elite just extract all of the rents from the commodity exports that you don't even call it corruption. It's just like they own it.
Literally.
But let's do that. Let's talk about what on earth is going on in Saudi Arabia, because it's in a lot of economic pain right now.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So, Jordan, like, can you draw the line here to Saudi Arabia? What kind of plight is Saudi Arabia in right now economically?
They're not making enough money.
that's because
of oil prices.
Oil prices are too low.
Yeah, oil prices are too low.
Have a massive, because of exactly what Anna was talking about, so that they need to spend a lot of money to keep the people happy.
Yeah, this is I think slightly different than, because it's like you said, it's more formalized. So Saudi Arabia needs oil prices fairly high just to fund its state budget and, you know, pay for its lifestyle. That's just how its economy works. It is a, you know, it's a petrostate.
But to be clear, the thing they need to pay for is precisely what Anna was talking about. There's a bunch of like non-royal family people in Saudi Arabia who are like very extremist and angry and want to blow up the world. And the way you kind of keep them under control is by throwing money at them.
That is part of the scheme. That is part of the hustle in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, this is what we see in, frankly, a lot of petrostates, where you have reduced freedoms for most of the people, lack of economic opportunity, but they pay no taxes. Their energy essentially costs nothing. And this is essentially the bargain that the population has with the leadership.
And, you know, since the 1970s, this hustle worked pretty well for Saudi Arabia because it was...
For the ruling party.
For the ruling party, yeah, right. But because it was essentially what we call a swing, you know, the swing producer.
Or the royal family, I guess.
Yeah, you know, the idea was that Saudi Arabia had the power to essentially draw up its oil production or draw it down in order to sort of manage prices the way it wanted. And sometimes during some periods, this worked better than others. But it could sort of dictate, with the help of OPEC, the status of the global oil market. It could basically decide what prices were going to be. And that sort of seems to be falling apart and has been falling apart for a long time, for several years now. And we got another kind of bit of news this week that showed how that whole framework was deteriorating.
So what is this piece of news? What's the news hook here?
Well, so the news hook is that OPEC has decided to keep production cuts that it agreed to in November for another 9 months, I believe, for another several months. And so you might recall the way oil prices basically collapsed a few years ago, right? Just like
November 2014.
Yeah, it was basically, yeah, right?
Adam was there.
I can tell you those few weeks after were, oh my God, I just remember in like watching the Russian market because it's so aligned with oil prices. It was
the ruble just like seemed like it was going to be worthless.
Yes.
I mean, it was a heady time, right? And so oil prices fell by more than half. And Saudi Arabia was sitting and it had this kind of question hanging. What was it going to do? Was it going to cut back production on its own in order to try and stabilize the market? Or was it just going to keep the pumps going? And it decided to just keep pumping, keep drilling. And
this was considered to be a kind of tactical move to drive all of the frackers in America out of business.
And also essentially to solidify market share. And the idea was they would really strengthen their relationship with their core consumers. The Saudis aren't stupid. They understood that at some point prices come back up, then the frackers, these new kind of shale drillers, are going to come back online. But the idea was they would have already really kind of solidified these consumer relationships. So
the way I think about this is that Saudi Arabia basically got into a pissing contest with the frackers, saying that, okay, we can pump oil till like there's no tomorrow, and we can do that with low oil prices because our cost of oil is very low.
Yeah.
And you can't. You're going to lose money on every barrel if prices are this low. And so you're going to have to shut down shop. And then it's going to be our game again. And the frackers, that did actually happen.
In
the first instance, a bunch of places shut down. But what has happened, which is absolutely fascinating to me, is that the private equity types who had pumped a lot of money into these U.S. oil companies and lost all of that money responded by putting even more money
down.
They doubled down, and now there's a real war.
Yeah, and it's because they recognize something, and I want to take a little victory lap here, Felix, because several years ago, you might not remember this, but I do. I suggested this might happen, that essentially that U.S. frackers would now become the new swing producer. They would be in that position that they could adjust their production up and down to kind of moderate global oil prices. And you told me, no, that's not going to happen. That's ridiculous. And instead, that's essentially the bet that the private equity guys have made. They've realized that, okay, there was this bust, but now a lot of these frackers have gotten tons more efficient. They've gotten their cost to get a barrel of oil out of the ground has like fallen by a third to a half in some cases. And so they've gotten better at it. They're able to make money at lower prices, and they can kind of inch up and make money. They can kind of inch up and move with the market. And so they are now putting money into these companies and they're sustaining them through this down cycle. The private equity guys are saying, okay, you don't have to make money right now because long term, we know you're going to be a good bet. And we're not going to deal with these crazy booms and busts because you can kind of move with the market.
And I think it's important to remember a few things. Like one, as a number of these companies that went through bankruptcy, then were coming out of bankruptcy, some of these restructurings involved like debt for equity swaps. So you now are probably going to have private equity firms more involved in the kind of day-to-day operations of how these essentially kind of like wildcat operations are working. And there's a question of moving forward what that is going to mean about how much they can spend on investment.
Well, yeah.
I mean, so right now it looks like they're investing a lot. All of these companies have negative free cash flow. They're all losing money and they are still perfectly happy to fund that.
But essentially what ended up happening was you did have a bit of a culling where right now you have the leanest, strongest companies are the ones that have been able to either survive or come out of bankruptcy. So the idea is these are potentially much more profitable companies now. They don't have as much debt. Their interest payments are less. The break-even price has declined. Now, that's a little more complicated than it looks on paper because part of the reason it's declined has been because of oil prices being really low. And so it's a bit more complicated than that. And I can also get into some other issues. But the reality is, it does appear that these companies are more apt to be profitable more quickly. So this isn't a stupid play by private equity.
Yeah.
Granted, I used to work in private equity, so.
So the question I have is, explain to me, if I lent a bunch of money to an oil fracker and then woke up one morning after a debt for equity swap owning the company. I'm like, okay, now I own an oil fracker. I have two choices. I can keep on pumping money and pumping oil, you know, and or I can just let it sit there for a while and not lose money and not pump oil and wait however many years it takes to wait for the oil price to come back up and then start minting money. No?
No, I mean, I do think that expectations of really, really ramping up production, I don't quite buy because I think that would involve more CapEx spending than they're willing to do at this point. But I don't think they're just going to sit there and wait because at this point, because break-even prices have declined, they can still make money at this price, especially if we start to keep oil prices above 50, near 50, and especially if we got towards 60.
Yeah, and so we should say what a break-even price is just for people.
So it's
just basically what the price of oil has to be for you to make money on it. And it's just a term of art, but that's what we're talking about there. And that is what's happened. They've gotten technologically more advanced.
Well, and it's not just part of it's technologically advanced. Part of it's also how they calculate it, because there's this thing called high grading where you write off your most inefficient wells and you calculate only based on your most efficient wells. So some of that has been going on as well.
And also, they have less debt.
We should probably come back to how this is, because I realize we lost our news hook here a little bit.
Does this have to do with Donald Trump in Saudi Arabia?
So what does this mean, right? So essentially, you had all these private equity guys jump into the market, and now they effectively own a lot what used to be these sort of crazy independent operations, and they've gotten the industry to function a little bit more stably in the United States. And these frackers aren't disappearing. They're not going away like Saudi Arabia thought. So back in November, Saudi Arabia got together with Russia, essentially, and they said, we can't kill off the frackers. It's not working. So instead, we need to reduce our own production in order to drain off the kind of oversupply that's in the world market. If we ever want to get prices back up for ourselves, we have to take this hit right now. And this was something Russia just doesn't typically do. And Saudi Arabia had to kind of, you know, it was this grand accord. They got them to agree. And so OPEC and Russia said, okay, we're going to cut production. And we'll come back and talk about this in May once we've drained off all these supplies. Except what happened? The frackers amped up their own production. And so it's taking longer to do that. And so what we're seeing is how quickly the U.S. market can respond and how it's left OPEC sort of not powerless, but it just doesn't have the ability to kind of tweak things the way it used to.
Yeah, OPEC, it wasn't that OPEC thought that the frackers were going to go out of business and never come back. They thought that they would be able to kind of tamp that down again while they focused on market share. They thought that the frackers wouldn't have as easy time getting access to affordable capital, which ended up not being the case. And now they're in a position where there's a bit of a question of why they've changed their strategy as quickly as they have. And there are a number of theories. They did actually change from Naimi, who had been in there forever in terms of overseeing oil policy, then a new person came in, about whether now when they're talking about IPOing Aramco, so much of that valuation is based on oil prices.
Okay, so now there's a whole bunch to unpack there. But there are three things we just need to sort of like keep in mind here. Number one, like act one, Saudi Arabia increases production in response to the fracking threat because it thinks it's going to drive the frackers out of business. That fails. Act two, Saudi Arabia switches tactics and decreases production in reaction to the fracking threat because they reckon that's the only way they're ever going to be able to raise prices. And then now what you're talking about is Act 3, which is Saudi Arabia has a new plan, which may or may not ever happen, which is maybe we shouldn't be so reliant on oil in the first place. And what we should do is sell our state oil company, Aramco, 5%. On the public markets and try and diversify our economy a little bit so we're not just a petrostate. And what they want to do is list Aramco on the international stock markets at a valuation of $2 trillion, which no one really believes they're going to be able to get. And so given that they're not going to be able to get that $2 trillion valuation, it's an interesting open question whether they are going to do it or not.
Right. Right. Because again, going back to this idea that the way that their government structure works depends on the ability to subsidize so much of their population. So they are facing a question of, in a just new oil market, we're not just talking about trying to get through a few years of low prices and then things come back. We're talking about a structurally different energy market.
Yeah.
Because we haven't even brought in a discussion of renewables and what that could look like in 10 to 20 years.
Or even your renewables in the Middle East, where now solar energy in the Middle East is cheaper than oil.
Yeah. Right. And I think the Saudis are not stupid. This is what they do. They understand that the market has dramatically changed. They think that there's still enough global demand to absorb the shale producers' production. And I think there's some argument that they're kind of waiting for global demand to increase. And I think that's actually one interesting area where the Saudis and the private equity guys are essentially in the same boat.
Yeah.
That they both think what ultimately is going to bring down supply is actually this these growth projections that still haven't come to pass. Everybody's banking everything on.
And then, but then there's also just the story we've been hearing for well over a decade now, which is the peak oil story, which is basically there's a finite amount of oil in the world, and as well, that amount of oil goes
that
down,
was really before a lot of the technology around
peak oil kind of died with
shale
fracking.
And offshore.
Now it's having, now it's oil getting stranded. That's more the story.
Right. And BP, though, still says they think that kind of global demand is going to peak around, I think, 2035. And because of a lot of reasons, but partly because we're going to see in the developing world a lot of laws related to, frankly, climate change and also just changing lifestyle patterns that people aren't going to be using the same amount of fossil fuels. They still think you're going to see demand increasing in the developing world. But there's a question. I mean, if you look at things we're getting out of India and China and how they're talking about, you know, moving forward, considering, I'm not saying they're switching overnight, but partly because they also have issues with pollution, which then is separate from climate change, but it creates a public support for new forms of energy, which again just brings into question these ideas about reducing supply by this eternal increase in demand.
Yeah. I mean, I think the kind of big picture issue here is that you have these commodity producing countries, these oil producing countries with various levels of corruption that have all sort of based their economies on selling oil, petrostates, various degrees. And first, you've had the frackers come and mess up their model. And now they're politically and economically struggling, and they're not quite sure what to do. And then you have, by the time they have figured out how to deal with fracking, with this kind of technological revolution, they're going to have to figure out how to deal with the decline of oil in general. And so after one storm hits, there's another coming for them. And what happens to them after that?
Right. And I mean, in a, you know, slightly side note, but I mean, again, ultimately, if a lot of petrostates would be forced to diversify their economy, I think that would actually be really good for the population and also as a society if people are using less oil and gas. That's also, I think, ultimately good for society. But we're talking about a part of the world that economy has been so dependent on these prices for so long. And that's not a simple shift.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's move on to something more fun here. The chief economist of the World Bank is one of the most high prestige jobs in the entire economic, possibly the most high prestige job in the entire economic profession. Everyone who's anyone has held it, from Stan Fisher to Joe Stiglitz to Larry Summers. And it is now held by Paul Romer, who is this much beloved economist, who has recently, in his sort of middle age, started getting a little bit cantankerous.
Very cantankerous. Delightfully cantankerous.
I don't know if he would like the word cantankerous. There are a lot of syllables.
I think he would like that word.
Even by economist standards.
Especially with other economists.
This is the thing that he has really started taking aim at the entire practice of economics.
He really has. And we should say, just for context, Paul Romer, like, he is already an extremely famous, like, beloved economist, but before he got this job at the World Bank, I mean,
that's why he got the job at the World Bank.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the job didn't elevate him. He almost elevated the job in this case.
Everyone said, oh my God, the World Bank managed to hire Paul Romer. They're like, wow.
He's regularly talked about as a Nobel Prize, you know, contender. And essentially, anytime you hear the words human capital, that's coming back to his theory of growth. I mean, he's largely responsible for something called endogenous growth theory. I won't get too deep into it. But whenever you hear about how important education and technology are to growing an economy, he sort of laid a lot of the theoretical groundwork for that. And so anyway, he's now just turned into, he's not a troll, but he's turned into, he's turned into like a scourge upon the profession. And maybe a good scourge.
And he's written a few papers, and I think we've talked about this in previous episodes, like taking aim at the entire practice of economics. And he's practicing what he preaches, or at least he seemed to be doing that. When he arrived in the World Bank, he looked at, and the World Bank is basically a couple of thousand PhD economists all sitting around in a whopping great building in Washington, D.C., doing abstruse economics and trying to work out how it
theory, this is related to financing infrastructure in the developing world.
Well, yes. No, I mean, in theory, this is exactly what Paul's problem was. And yeah, this goes back to this wonderful paper which was published by Stanford's Literary Lab a couple of years ago. And I would highly recommend reading this paper because it's just awesome. And
I've pulled out some choice tidbits for later.
The title of the paper is Bank Speak, The Language of World Bank Reports 1946 to 2012. And basically what they did was they just looked at World Bank reports over decades and looked at how the language changed. And Paul Romer has really clearly internalized this paper and taken it very, very seriously and even literally. Once upon a time, to your point, Anna, this is what the economists did, was that they tried to look at the effect of infrastructure investments on national economies and that kind of thing. And then more recently, it's becoming more and more abstruse and abstract and less related to concrete things in the world and more related to random things like good governance or something like that. And so Paul, in becoming the World Bank chief economist, also wound up being the direct boss of like 600 of these World Bank economists. And he turned around to these 600 economists who he was in charge of and said, okay, enough of this abstract nothingness, which means nothing. I want you to get back to actually saying concrete things about realities on the ground. And I'm going to force you to start getting specific about things. And this did not go down well.
No, they basically took his job away.
Yes.
I mean, like, he's still technically the chief economist, but they took all of his management responsibilities away.
And they claimed somewhat that it was because he told them they used "and" too much.
Yeah, so if you read this paper, I was a little skeptical of Romer's militant anti-conjunction position. Yeah, thank you for finishing that for me. But when you read this paper, you actually see it's sort of a serious issue because the World Bank's focus kind of goes from, it transforms. At first, it's very much about fixing poverty, dealing with things like agriculture. And you see those words reflected in the language used in its reports. And then all of a sudden, by the end of it, it's all about this bureaucratic ease. And essentially, they become very concerned with programs and their own.
Okay, so let me give my favorite example from the paper is where they look at the words surrounding the word poverty in papers. And then they also look at the words surrounding the term poverty reduction. And the words surrounding the term poverty are things like total cost, population, income, services, problems, resources, food, health, agriculture, you know, real things which we should study. And one would expect naively that if you're talking about poverty reduction, one would get a similar set of terms. One would be wrong, because the actual terms surrounding poverty reduction are strategies, programs, policies, focus, key, management, report, goals, approach, projects, framework, priorities, and papers.
Yes.
So and that is what Roma was.
It's this bizarre solipsism of the World Bank, where everything is focused on their own kind of procedure and the things that people who've been through the Kennedy School of Government might care about, but not necessarily a farmer in Brazil.
I think it's important. It's not just a semantic issue, because it relates to the mission of the bank itself. And as they're focusing on theory and writing these abstruse documents, you have the Chinese infrastructure bank actually getting involved much more in the developing world. And what does that mean?
And this brings us back to this question of and.
Yes.
Which is the, there was a lot of people laughing on Twitter about the fact that Paul Roma would look at the percentage of words that were the word and he would cap it at 4%.
Honestly, that may have been too high.
But you're like, so I have one of the passages that was brought up in the paper that is, this is why Paul Roma hates the word and, is because there was this passage from the 1999 report. I mean, this is not new. This goes back 20 years, where they want to, quote, promote corporate governance and competition policies and reform and privatize state-owned enterprises and labor market social protection reform. There is greater emphasis on quality responsiveness and partnerships, on knowledge sharing and client orientation, and on poverty reduction.
Do they just hate commas?
It's partly that they hate commas, but it's more that what they're doing is they're concatenating a whole bunch of different things which don't belong together. As the authors of the Stanford reports say, knowledge sharing has really nothing to do with client orientation. Poverty reduction, nothing to do with either. But if you just throw them all together into a laundry list of things like governance, which are good things, you lose the specificity, but you get to sound like you're
right. Sound cool. You can publish this. You say, oh, look how clever I am. But you're not actually creating any change in the world. You're not actually helping people.
Have either of you ever had any experience having to write sentences like this? I'm curious, because I have, and I want to talk a little bit about like how it happens to some. So when I was reading this, and this is going to sound really mundane, but I had acid flashbacks to my days having to write like advertising copy for a law firm. And how is this related? And the reason is because you're essentially writing by committee to some extent, and you're trying to please all these different stakeholders who all have little pet things they want to insert, and you don't want to offend anybody, and so you have to put everything in the vaguest possible language, which often involves some really obnoxious use of the passive voice or whatnot. And by the end, you have something that you can hand to like six very well-paid, you know, economists or lawyers in my case, and no one will be offended because they see their little part of it is there, but it means jack shit. And so like it seems like at some point you've just lost your, and it's a sign of having lost your mission, that there's no point to what you're
doing. I think this also speaks to the mission creep at the World Bank itself, which has been a criticism of the mission of the World Bank for a number of years.
Well, this is also the mission creep in the economic profession. Like, and this is where the Paul Roma criticism of economics generally overlaps with the Stanford linguistic criticism of economics as it's practiced at the bank, which is that economics has turned into itself, and that it is increasingly finding it difficult to say helpful things about the real world. It has become much more macro. It is becoming much less likely to say something about a dam.
I disagree with that a little bit, because I think Paul Romer's criticism of economics is a criticism specifically of macro. His criticism is of basically this turn that happened in the 1970s, and not necessarily even the turn it took then, but how it was interpreted by people who came afterwards. And it's about the assumptions, that the kind of crazy assumptions that go into these models that tell you that monetary policy doesn't matter in the end. Like that's his, what he's upset with macro. Economics in general has actually become a lot more empirical over that same time. And so that's sort of the contrast, I think.
And it's a big criticism of Romer, is that some of his criticisms sometimes appear to be against a form of economics that isn't the type that is actually practiced by a lot of economists
now,
today.
Yeah.
But the fact is that the common thread here is that he is in favor of grounded specificity and against unfalsifiable hand waving.
Yes, that is
and
very true.
And so he comes in with this crusade.
Yeah.
He's like, no unfalsifiable hand waving. And he gets ousted. Like, the unfalsifiable hand wavers basically win this battle.
It's, yeah, it again is where the bureaucrats have their day.
And that- this is despite the fact that the head of the World Bank, Jim Kim, is also famously trying to shake up and do a lot of like management changes and get the people out into the field and doing more real things. And he seems to be safer in his job. It's weird that like Jim Kim seems to be safer in his job than Paul Romer.
You know, this could also just be, you know, a matter of style, right? And not just grammatical style, but like, you know, if you... leadership style. Like, he may have had the right idea and just pissed off enough people so quickly that it wasn't sustainable. I mean, I do think it's a little bit unfortunate that bureaucrats seem to have won at a point where the World Bank's relevance is suddenly coming into question, or not suddenly, is coming into question for a long time, but even more so now, like you were saying, with China sort of trying to take on this mantle. But yeah, I mean, he may have had the right idea and been the wrong guy.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
Okay. Numbers round. So Jordan Weissman not only came into the studio today with his laptop, as is his wont, but also has a literal physical copy of The New Yorker.
I'm an ink-stained wretch today because The New Yorker ink still like wipes off on your hands. Yeah, so I guess it's time for my number then, right? My number is 38,000. That's essentially how much sand 1 mile of American interstate highway requires to produce 38,000 tons of sand. And why am I bringing this
up? Are we reaching peak sand?
Basically, there's a New Yorker article about how like we are using more sand than really is sustainable, like worldwide. And it's partly because of the vast amounts of it that go into things like concrete, glass. Our world is built on sand, and it's so metaphorically apt, and we're running out of the sand, and it's all going to crumble anyway. And that's all I have to say.
And actually, that's fitting with my number, because part of where what was using all of that sand has been the Chinese government in terms of building
one day Anna's going to have a number which is not Chinese, China? But that day is not today.
I don't think you ever should.
No, it is not
you
today.
You do, Anna.
So my number is 164%, and that's the corporate debt to GDP ratio in China. So this past week, Moody's downgraded China for the first time, I think, since 1989. So even though they're still far in investment grade territory, this is significant in terms of Moody's pointing out that we should be paying attention
okay,
to Chinese
debt.
Okay,
so let's just be clear about this number. If you add up all of the corporate debt in China
and all of the household and all of the quasi, then you actually get over 300, almost 300%.
But if you add up all of the corporate debt in China, it comes to 164% of GDP.
Yes.
And that is so high, partly because all of the banks are state-owned, or many of the banks are state-owned, that actually affects China's sovereign credit.
Well, yes, of course, because a lot of these are contingent liabilities, because the idea is that if a state-owned enterprise can't pay its debt, the government is then going to pay the debt.
And my number, just to finish this off, is 16%, or 0.16, I guess. Foursquare, you know that little game which you play on your phone where you check in places? It turns out...
It's still there.
It still exists, and they have 132 million users or something enormous, and they... are on many phones, and they can see how many people are traveling around the world. And they know when you're traveling around the world. And they can look at where you're traveling to. And depending on whether you're going to amusement parks or to convention centers, they can make a pretty good guess as to whether you're a leisure traveler or a business traveler. And so what they did was they looked at all of the non-American users of Foursquare and tried to say, well, how many of those people are traveling to America for leisure, not for business? How many? Basically, this is a way of measuring international tourism to America.
Okay.
And what they found is that in March, the amount of international tourism to America is 16% lower than it was a year previously.
Why might that be?
And we will get the official numbers about, you know, tourism entries into America in about 6 months. But this is the first very early indication that there's been a massive, massive effect on international tourism into America in 2017.
And who knows why that could be?
Maybe because
of someone who's not currently in America. We shall not be named.
Maybe he'll be detained at the border.
Yes.
We can only pray.
On which Trumpish note we shall bring this episode of Slate Money to an end. Do listen to all the other shows on Panoply at panoply.fm. Many thanks to Dan Schrader and to the other producer types around these parts, such as Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers and June Thomas. Write to us. Our email address is always slatemoney@slate.com. Leave us a review over at Apple Podcasts. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
And that's an additive, like this and that. But that's sort of the opposite. Not this, but that. And then there's or. O-R. When you have a choice like this or that. And
without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.